So, Mike, how's the bullet journaling going?
Well, if you are defining bullet journaling as the method that writer Carol outlined in our last book, then probably not that great.
Oh, come on.
But if you are defining bullet journal as an analog system with paper and pen where I jot everything down, then awesome. So I am really loving this, but I am definitely not doing it by the book.
Okay. Can I ask what you're doing then?
You may. So I am doing a single page spread every day for time blocking. And I can take a picture of one of my daily pages and put that in the show notes so people can see it. But basically, time blocking on the left, below that, I've got a box for my highlight. Below that, I've got the five tasks that I'm going to get done in a day. And it limits it to five because of the space on the paper that I have in my notebook, which finally came in. And that is the Ugmunk Heirloom Journal. It's this leather disc-bound journal, which I found out is compatible with the Levenger Circa system. So I actually am going to be experimenting with some other paper types.
I did not know that you could swap between those two. I thought it was one or the other.
Yeah, well, I emailed in after I had used it for about a week because I wasn't super happy with the paper that's in here. It's got a lot of feathering with some of my broader fountain pens, so that's no good. And they said that it's compatible with disk-based systems, so I have a Levenger Circa Punch coming tomorrow, and I've got some Rhodia pads here, which are a little bit small, and I've got some, Clearfontaine Triumph coming from Anderson Pens shortly. So I'm going to be trying to punch some better paper and use that instead. But basically, the size of the paper, it's an A5 notebook. So it limits the number of things that I can put on that side of the page, which is kind of perfect. And then on the right side of the page, that's where I take all of my notes. It could be meeting notes. It could be just things that I'm thinking about that I need to jot down. But that's kind of my daily log. I have not landed on a symbol system yet. I know you were using the Dash Plus, which I think I like better than the bullet journal one, but I have trouble remembering the symbols in like the middle of a meeting and I'm trying to jot down things. So I've just been jotting down bullets basically and then cleaning it all up after the fact.
Sure.
Hopefully that'll get a little bit smoother, but that's what I've got on the front of my journal. I've got a couple of tabs for different collections, and I really am not doing a whole lot with these, but I do have one that I'm using to track my habits.
Okay.
I always resisted habit tracking paper pencil because I thought I would never do it. Turns out I really enjoy it.
Nice.
So okay. Real simple, just names of the habits on the left, number line from left to right on the top. I'm doing this kind of landscape, and then X's for the days that I actually did the things, kind of inspired by the thing that you sent, minus the fancy graphs.
Sure.
For
sure.
How many hours I slept and all that stuff. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. And
nice.
I like it a lot. I've been doing it since we recorded last time, so a couple of weeks. And I think this is going to stick. I still am keeping my tasks in OmniFocus and grabbing them from there at the beginning of my day, or when I'm planning my day for the next day, so that I can hit the ground running. You know, I look in OmniFocus. If there's anything urgent in there, basically, then that's going on the list. Otherwise, I just sit and think about what do I want to get done tomorrow, and then I'll put those things on there. Last time we were talking about my fascination with Rome research, I think that has passed. I get it.
Sure.
I get the hype. I see people using it and it is really, really cool. The bidirectional linking, I do think, is kind of a game changer. But at the same time, you open up Rome research and it takes you to a daily page where you're supposed to be capturing everything, and I'm not doing it there. So I feel like I'm not even giving Rome research a decent shot. They're about to come out of beta. Who knows how much it's going to cost? I've heard $15 a month. I've heard $30 a month. There's no way I'm getting $30 a month worth of value out of it. So you inspired me because I was asking you some questions. You said you can basically do this in NVAlt with the wiki style links.
Yeah.
And you can. The problem with that is you put a link in and it's only one way. The other note does not link back to the one that you just linked to. That's the beauty of Rome, in my opinion. But NV Ultra does have a handy little tab for connected notes. And it's not just the ones that have links between them, but supposedly, I don't know how it all works, but Brett Terpstra is a genius. So I don't have enough in NV Ultra to really gauge whether this is effective, but the whole idea of NV Alt and NV Ultra is you type something in the top and searches for something, and you can change the way that it searches from just like the keyword to connected notes that are similar to the type of note that you have or something like that. So I think that can kind of replace some of the bidirectional linking of Roam Research for me. And I know it's not nearly the same thing. It's not going to get me true Zettelkasten, but since I'm using a bullet journal, a digital Zettelkasten is probably not going to happen anyways. So
that's fair.
All the things are still moving, but that's kind of where I'm at right now.
I'm pulling up mine just to see. Well, yeah, because like everything in mine is borderline connected. So it shows a ton when I do that.
Okay.
It's kind of cool though, because like, and I mentioned this to you, because anyone who's in NV Alt or NV Ultra, like the thing about that is that you can just type the bracket and then start typing and it does the search. You drop it in, just like what you would see in Roam, which is why when I first saw Roam and was seeing the different things that it was doing, I couldn't help but immediately think of NV Alt/NV Ultra and wonder if it was a complete ripoff. Like that was my take on it. I didn't know if that was legit or not. So I am far from even interested in trying Roam, because I feel like it's normal in NV Alt. So I don't know why it's now becoming a big thing. Maybe because people just haven't been able to understand it in NV Alt. Maybe it's because of the because you can get Roam on mobile devices, right? Because it's the whole responsive web app
kind of concept. Yeah.
I think that's maybe the thing NV Alt slash NV Ultra doesn't really have an iOS app per se. I mean, you can get a lot of the features through Simple Note and syncing it that way, but that's just not a route I want to go at all. Sorry, not going to be trying Roam anytime soon. Don't expect a working with Roam Research from Joe anytime soon.
Which is fine. You know, I get it. I see people use it, and it is different than NV Alt or NV Ultra. Thomas Frank, the guy who used to do the College Info Geek, and now he's a pretty successful YouTuber, did a pretty awesome video of how he uses it and how it ties everything together, and it makes his writing and creation process pretty seamless. But yeah, I feel like you don't need all of that if you're going to be doing some things in the bullet journal, unless you are going to transfer absolutely everything that you ever write down. And at that point, why not just go digital? And I do think that a lot of the fascination with Roam recently is because there are some big names like that who have kind of brought attention to it. And that has spurred some stuff. I shared a tweet with you of somebody had asked for wiki style links inside of Drafts. And that's kind of the same thing that's in NV Alt. In fact, your comment to me was, looks like NV Alt.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that is because I think people look at the Roam Research on the surface and they're like, oh, there's a link to another note. Well, can I do that in something else? But that's not really what it is. The bidirectional linking is really the powerful thing there, because that creates all of the connections from whatever way you would approach whatever you are trying to find. That's missing in NV Alt, and it's missing in the stuff from Drafts, but it's also the thing that's being brought to the surface is like, hey, this is what Roam does. This is what I'd like to do in something else, which is kind of where I'm landing with NV Ultra. I think that's where that's going to fit in my workflow. It's not going to be Roam, but it's going to be good enough. I'll have my wiki, but it won't be a true Zettelkasten, and I'll be fine.
Sure.
And in the meantime, I'm just going to keep using my paper pen for everything else, because I really, really enjoy that.
Go for it. No, I think that, you know, whenever you sent me the thing of Greg Pierce looking at putting these links, these wiki links into Drafts, I have no interest in that, because nothing stays in Drafts. Drafts is a temporary holding place for me. Like, I know that people use it as a writing tool.
That's what NVAlt always was for me on the Mac.
Sure.
The inbox, and then you send it somewhere else.
Yep.
So
yep.
I get that approach, but also I recall when I first started doing things that way, because I started off with NVAlt, it was repository for everything. And then I made that switch. I'm like, huh, you know what? I should really just use this as an inbox and process it all the time. And then that's basically how I've been using it for several years now. And so I get that approach with drafts, but I also think drafts is very similar to NVAlt, where you could use it as a repository if you wanted to. There's a lot of powerful tools in there. I'm not sure if that's how Greg Pierce had imagined it at the beginning or not, but
sure,
you could do that. It has the technical capability to be used that way. I don't think one way is necessarily right or wrong.
Correct.
But yeah. I know when you get sucked into one, you tend to not even think like, well, of course other people can use it this way, because you're like, no one would ever use it except the way that I'm using it.
Of course. This is the one and only way to use this.
This is the logical way.
I mean, the whole workspaces thing in drafts is kind of cool, but I really only use it as like ways to segment quotes or micro blogs that I'm going to post a little bit later, but I'm not ready to do it. Like, it will hold those, but inevitably everything always either gets eventually trashed because I've actioned it off, or just deleted because I just decided I'm not going to use it anymore. So like, that is how I end up using drafts. But you know, in my case, Envy Ultra ends up being my digital note-taking system, which I don't use a ton. Like, it's not a thing that comes out very often, but you know, it is kind of a writing place of sorts. I do want to come back to, because I did do a monthly migration in my bullet journal. I suppose I didn't really follow up with that.
Yeah, I want to hear how your bullet journal process is going.
So I had almost an entire month. I had like 3 weeks of April where I was running a bullet journal system. And then I did my monthly migration into May. And I'm still pretty strong on, I don't want to say everything to the letter by writer Carol's intent, but I'm not far off. I think the only thing I've run into that I might be adding to his system is some form of like a weekly log, because I have found that I tend to get tasks or want to explore tasks on a weekly basis, where I know, like, I get it on Monday and I know I need to do it on Wednesday. Well, I'll write it down in my rapid log for that day, my daily log, but it's kind of messy getting it into 2 days later. Like, if it was just the next day, that's easy. You just migrate it one line down. But when it goes to 2 days out, like, that's when I start to get a little odd on things. Or if I catch it on Tuesday and I know I need it for Friday, that's where things start to get a little bit messy. But I'm still working through that, trying to figure out what that process is going to look like. But I can tell you, this has been, like, as far as like, whenever I adopt new systems, it seems like it's easy for me to do it for the first 2 or 3 weeks, because at that point it's still new and shiny. And this is actually one where I have been capturing things in notebooks for a long time, so the new and shiny period wore off pretty quick. In this case, I knew it was over after about a week, maybe a week and a half, that new and shiny in this particular case, which meant that I've been working this system after that period longer than I've been in it. Does that make sense? I feel like I'm rambling, but that's the way that it's been working, and it's been going really well. Like, even today, I suppose I could look, because you know what? My bullet journal has gone everywhere with me anymore. I have 15 things logged for today already, and it is 1:30 at this moment. So, you know, I'm doing pretty well with it. I've enjoyed the process of writing things by hand into it, and it just seems like I've been a lot more productive with it. Something I hadn't planned on, Mike, is that I've been like logging my interactions with other people, which is kind of interesting. Like, you know, meetings or interesting tidbits about people that have happened throughout the day, which is especially helpful right now given the season of life that's occurring for the world. And
right.
it's been interesting to just keep track of how many times I've had fun interactions with other people. But I think the part that's probably more interesting right now is like I've been specifically trying to nail down what my flavor of ADD looks like right now, because it's getting worse and quickly. So I've been trying to like log little bits of, hey, I did this and it did not work at all. Like, so I've been doing quite a bit of that as well. Just trying to keep an eye on what is my ADD doing and do I need to play games with myself in order to get things accomplished? Like, I've been trying to track some of that as well in that logging mechanism. It's been very interesting. So I can stop talking about it now because I feel like this is the sort of thing I could go on and on and on about. Thus, I'm like working on analog membership sites. So here we go. Joe's on to another thing. But I've been really enjoying it. I think this is something I'm going to be using for quite some time at this point.
Cool. I definitely think I'm going to be using mine too. I am a little bit concerned about your weekly log because I think, I don't remember exactly, but I did edit the last episode and I think you and I both agreed that the weekly thing seemed like too much. So
yeah.
It seems to me like you are inching closer and closer towards doing a weekly review inside of a bullet journal, and it's a bunch of additional effort added to writer curl system, which is fine if it clicks and it works. But I could see that just becoming untenable in the long run.
Yeah.
Once the new and shiny wears off. I know you basically said you're past the new and shiny, but
yeah, no, and that's very fair. And I think the kicker here is like this is not a weekly review. It's just these are the tasks that I need to do later in the week.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm setting those particular days for when something needs to happen and just reviewing that each day. So there is no, like, there's not really a weekly migration of any kind because it's okay. Just a reviewing that on a daily basis to see, is there something that I need to do each day in order to, you know, accomplish the things I've set out for myself. So that's mostly what I'm after. It's not really a, here are the things for the entire week that I need to be doing. Like, no, this is setting a specific day to do a task because, you know, I may not have all the slides I need for Sunday's service until Friday, so it's not even worth trying to do it until Friday. So I'm going to set that on Friday. How do I do that? Like, that's that particular scenario is the one that I'm trying to solve.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. Oh, one other thing I should mention with my system, because I mentioned I've got the Disbound journal, which again, blasphemous to true Bujoers, but I like to move my pages around. And I think that this makes it a lot easier for me to just flip to the next open page and start doodling something because I can keep it with all the other stuff when I want. I get that's the goal of the index, but I just want to be able to move these things. And I also want to be able to archive them digitally so I can go find stuff later when I'm done with them, like my old daily spreads. And I should report back on that because in the last episode, I was saying it would be great if I could do all this stuff inside of day one because I've got so much stuff inside of day one already. I've got my journaling template that I complete every night. I've got song ideas. I've got jokes. I've got quotes. I've got so much stuff. But day one is really terrible at scanning things. You can basically take a picture and attach it to a journal entry, and that's it. You can't do anything with that. It's not OCR'd, so you can't search for it later, and it's just not an elegant workflow at all. However, GoodNotes is amazing at this. With GoodNotes, I don't know if this is like an iOS, like a system level thing, or if they built this themselves, but there's a scanning engine inside of GoodNotes where you don't even have to be like directly over the page. I can scan it on an angle, like a 45 degree angle from like across the room, and it recognizes that this is the page. It shows the highlight on the camera. You hold it still, it scans it, and then it like flattens it all out, makes it a square. You can see all the text perfectly and applies OCR pretty much instantly. And you can just throw that in another notebook, and then you can search your library and you can find that stuff whenever you want it. It's pretty amazing how GoodNotes can actually interpret handwritten text and make it findable. But as much as I want day one to be the perfect solution for this. It's not. And I've kind of landed on being okay with just creating a separate bullet journal archive notebook inside of GoodNotes and then just throwing all of my daily stuff in there when I'm done with the day.
Sure. This is kind of weird to hear you say that day one can't do something.
I know. I love day one.
You know what I mean?
I love day one. And it would be the ideal place for this stuff because I have so many other journals in day one, but it just can't do it. And I was trying to shoehorn it in. I tried to make a shortcut using, what is that, Toolbox Pro, where you can OCR an image and then put it into day one through this convoluted shortcut. But even that wasn't working that great. And then I'm like, well, maybe I should just try it in GoodNotes. And, you know, it sort of worked, but not really. And then I went into GoodNotes and it was so simple, so easy. It takes like 2 seconds. So it's much to my chagrin, I guess. I shouldn't say that because I really do like GoodNotes. I do all my sketch notes and stuff in there. Uh-huh. But this is the thing where I really wanted this with all the other journal type stuff. And it's just not the right tool for the job at the moment. So into GoodNotes it goes.
I'm sorry, Mike, but I'm also happy for you.
Thank you.
Kudos on being willing to set aside the tool you wanted to work. That's not always an easy thing to do. It's like, oh, I could do this in OmniFocus? Okay. Is it difficult? Yep. Am I going to do it anyway? Yep. Like that's...
Yeah.
I will spend 3 days writing a script so that I don't have to use a different tool. Like that's...
Right. Yeah.
Yep. That's the way things go. So anywho, should we transition into today's book? Because I feel like we could go on this for quite some time.
That was a nice nudge you just gave me there.
I know, right? Let's just, just go for it. So today's book is Nudge by Richard Thaler. Gosh, I didn't look it up, Mike. Richard Thaler, one of those, and Cass Sunstein. And this is about the concept of making small, I don't want to say default answers, but small decisions for people so that they are more inclined to make good decisions. Now, this could be you for someone else. It could be you for yourself. You know, this is something I talk about playing tricks on myself. This is kind of a way to do that. It's like this covers a very wide range of territory, but that's probably the most succinct way I could possibly explain this. How would you explain it, Mike?
A libertarian manifesto? I'm not exactly sure. they do make, in the beginning of the book, they define what they call libertarian paternalism because they recognize at the very beginning that all of these nudges can be used for good or evil, and people are going to either wish that people would nudge them towards making right decisions or completely resist that based on their political affiliations. And the last chapter, which I don't think we have a section here to get to this, but the last chapter is basically the case, a summary of everything that they've done, and then the case for libertarian paternalism, they say. And they basically say, like, there's this two-party system, and they advocate for the third way. And I feel like with that last chapter, what you really see is everything in the book kind of leading up to that. That's probably not entirely fair, but they definitely took advantage of that to like get one last shot in there and be like, well, the way you're doing it isn't working, so maybe you should think about it our way. And they're really smart university professors, so it's really hard to argue with them. But I think for most people who would identify as either a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican, there's going to be lots of stuff in here that's going to make you feel uncomfortable. That's not necessarily a bad thing, by the way. We should want to be able to wrestle through those types of things because it just kind of helps us land on the right thing. But so don't necessarily just like resist the things that are different or challenging, but recognize what you're getting into as you read this book, I guess.
Yeah. So Richard Thaler is the winner of the 2017 Nobel Prize in Economics. So you should know that. And he is also a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. Sometimes it bugs me that these titles are so long. And then Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School. So, you know, not exactly people who don't have experience in this world, in this realm. So they are very qualified to discuss this, I think I would join you in saying that there's a lot in here that I struggled with from a political stance and from a religious stance to some degree. And I wasn't certain how to handle it. Like, because you can take a lot of what they say to their point. Like, you can take this and spin it for evil. You can take it and spin it for good. But in either case, it's a challenge to determine where the line is between those two.
Yes. Yes, it is. And the way that they talk about stuff makes it seem like, oh, well, the answer is obvious. You just haven't considered it this way. I know we'll get into this in the section on freedom, but one of the chapters in the freedom section is on the privatizing marriage. And they basically make the argument that there's all of this contention around what is marriage, should same-sex marriages be allowed? And they basically say, well, the only reason this is an issue is because of the word marriage. So we should let churches use marriage and everybody else use civil unions, and there, problem solved. And I don't think it's quite that simple. But also, because they're really smart, you know, it's hard to argue with the arguments that they lay out, because they lay out their arguments really well. And that's one chapter, one small section. But there's obviously a whole lot there to unpack. So I found, as I was reading through those different sections, after we get past the humans and econs part one, you know, then they get into like different sections on money and health and freedom. Those, I feel like I got to wrestle with some of that stuff. Raised a lot of questions. And not having all the answers immediately after you're done with the book isn't necessarily a bad thing, but that is what you're signing up for when you read this.
So let's just jump in here. There are five parts that we'll go through here. The first of those is humans and econs. And the best way I could probably explain this is that an econ is a person who acts and delivers action to themselves and makes decisions based on historical information and deciding what is the best given all the data for their future. And you're always acting in your own best interest. I would say that's the easiest way to explain an econ versus a human, where emotions are involved and dopamine is involved, and the want to do fun things, even in spite of all the bad things that could happen, like that is involved. So, you know, choosing, you don't really get to choose one or the other. I would say we're all humans in some form. I'm sure there are a few econs, Spock, out there who will act in the best interest in every scenario, but I'm far from that. Like that is not me at all. So this will be an interesting conversation. But that's the way I think to explain both of those.
So the two different systems that he talks about in here, this kind of is another version of the humans and econs, where the automatic system is rapid and instinctive, it's uncontrolled, it's effortless, it's unconscious, it's associative, it's fast, and the reflective system is the deliberate one, the self-conscious one, controlled, effortful, deductive, and slow. And I feel like a lot of that harkens back to the Thinking Fast and Slow with Daniel Kahneman that we read. In fact, a lot of this intro section here, a lot of these stories I had heard before from the other books that we've read. But I thought like that helped me really attach to these terms, humans and econs, where humans are the ones who are going to react instinctively and emotionally and probably make dumb decisions if we let them. And the econs are the ones who are always going to choose the right path to maximize the output of happiness or whatever resource they're trying to conserve. And so the whole idea of nudge is to nudge people away from the instinctive reaction, the instinctive decision, which is not going to be in their best interest, and into the econ mode where they think things through rationally and they pick the right one. Just describing that, you probably see a lot of issues, potential issues anyways, with that. who gets to decide what is best for people. And that comes to the surface right at the beginning here. And it doesn't really, I don't think, you know, like I said, I got to the end of this, I didn't feel like I had an answer to that as much as they tried to say, like, this is the answer. I don't think it's quite that simple, but it did really get me thinking about these things. And I think that's the real value in a book like this, is not in the answers that it gives you, but in the questions that it raises. You know, 6 months from now, I'll probably still be thinking about some of the stuff in this book. And definitely a challenging book, no matter which side of the aisle you happen to fall on.
Right, right. And just as an example, like one of the first stories that they kick off the introduction with, I think it was the introduction, is about an individual, a lady who sets up school lunch trays. So like the students can go through and they're selecting what they want for lunch. Pretty straightforward, right? But what they do is ask the question, how should she set that up? Should she, because they know that students tend to choose from certain areas that are either easily accessible, they're right up front, they're the first thing they see. Like, those are the things that people tend to choose. You know, they do the same thing in grocery stores. The things that are eye level, like the shelf space that's eye level, is the most expensive for the suppliers to rent. So that's because that's where people tend to have their eyes go first, and it's much higher selection by choice whenever things are in those areas. Same thing with school lunches. So the question is, do you put fruits and veggies in the most selected area, or do you put pizza and chips there because that's what the students want? Like, do you put what the students want, or do you choose what is best for them? And who gets to say what? Like, who gets to say that one is better than the other? That's the dilemma here. And I think that's where we could get into this conversation of, is that an evil way of using this information, or is that the right way of using this information? You know, I, of course, have my own opinions, but I think even my own opinions with these things tend to conflict with each other. Yeah. When I'm looking at these, like, well, no, in that case, I want you to do this. And in that scenario, I want you to do that. But don't cross those lines, because, and don't make me see them side by side, because they're not going to be congruent with each other. So it's tricky, but that's the concept here.
He also talks about planners and doers being like two sides of yourself, where the planners take steps to control the actions of the doers. And the example that he uses here is, you put the alarm clock on the other side of the room, and then he has this ridiculous example of an ad that takes us to the next level.
This is not ridiculous. I thought this was genius.
Have you ever seen one of these things?
No, but I wish I had.
Okay. So they include this ad for, it's called Clocky, and it's an alarm clock that when it goes off, it has two wheels on the side. It rolls off of your nightstand and then across the room, and you have to go find it and dig it out from underneath the dresser or the bed or something in order to turn it off. So basically the alarm goes off and the alarm clock runs away from you as the ultimate example of the planner setting up this system to get the doer out of bed in the morning. This is hard for me to wrap my head around, but I know that there are other examples where I am just as susceptible to this kind of thing in my own life. So it seems ridiculous to me, that specific example, but I also understand the logic behind it and really what they're trying to hack together with that approach. And I think there is some validity to that for sure.
Yeah, this is kind of getting into one of the chapters within this part, Resisting Temptations. And I kind of laughed whenever I read about Clocky, but at the same time, I was thinking, that is absolutely the sort of thing that I have to have, because I get distracted too easy. And just as an example, Mike, you've been to our house. We have a bathroom upstairs, which is right next to our bedroom. And then there's a bathroom down in what used to be my office, but I guess that's where I'm sitting right now. There's a bathroom down here as well. And in the morning when I get up, I always come to the downstairs bathroom to get ready, because it tends to make a lot of noise and I don't want to wake up the kids upstairs. So what I did was, in order to get to the bathroom, there's only one little hallway through the, our family room to get to it. And I lay out the yoga mat that I use on that little pathway. It's not an ideal spot for yoga, but there are definitely better places for me to do that in the morning. But if I set the mat there, I have to walk over top of that mat in order to go use the bathroom. And then if I want to go anywhere else in the house, I have to walk over top of it again. And I feel guilty walking over this mat and not doing my yoga practice in the morning. So I end up doing yoga more often as a result of having that mat sitting there. I feel like that's the sort of thing that he's talking about here, but it's something I have to do this all the time. I will forget things or choose not to do them because I don't want to, or if it's too many steps to do it. This is the whole like eliminating resistance thing. Like that's similar to what this is, but I find that that's the sort of thing I have to do. It's silly. It's ridiculous that we have to do that sort of thing, but it's the sort of thing I have to do. I don't know. Is this something you have to do to yourself? I don't know that this is universal, but some of us are more, you know, our executive functioning is more advanced than others, I think.
Well, it's not something... Well, I should say I've used that sort of tactic previously, but I have not used it recently. So the exercise thing, I think that's one of the ones where this would manifest more frequently. And to be honest, my whole exercise routine has been revamped significantly since the whole COVID-19 thing. Can't go to the gym anymore. I was going to the gym 6 days a week. So to help me deal with that and also to help me just kind of get a reset every day, I've been getting outside. And the way that I do that is I either go for a run or I go for a bike ride. And those were things that were part of my normal routine, but I am basically running or biking every single day now. And I don't have to put my running shoes in the middle of the bedroom floor so that I see them and I remember to take a run. There was a point when I would do something like that, but I feel like I've made the adjustments that I've wanted to make for this period. And now it's just kind of like, well, it is what it is. If I was going to apply this tactic to anything, it would probably be with the books that we read, because as I was telling you before we hit record, during this self-isolation thing, I've having a real hard time getting through the books that we read for Bookworm. If it would not be for Bookworm, I probably would not be reading right now. So it's helping that to stick at least a little bit, but I was having a gap book like every single week, and now I haven't had one for, I don't know, 4 episodes in a row or something. So maybe you could argue that doing that with a physical book, that would be something that I could do, just like putting it, I don't know, on my nightstand, so I see it first thing in the morning and I grab it when I grab my journal and I'm planning out my day and I just take it with me everywhere. I tend to leave it in a part of the house and not think about it until kids have gone to bed, and then either I pick it up and read it like I'm supposed to, or I don't feel like it because I'm too tired. Just being real here.
Sure.
So I haven't been doing much of this lately, I guess is the short answer, but
sure.
I see the value in it, and I think it's a great trigger for positive habits that you want to help create stickiness for.
Yeah, one of the other chapters in this section is called Following the Herd. And I merely wanted to just mention that this is a thing that is in the book, mostly because we know that this happens. We have a tendency to follow everybody else, and we want to be like the people we are around, but it can lead to some pretty detrimental outcomes if we're not careful and actually thinking through what it is that we're doing. And like, this is something I find myself doing more often than I want, and have been trying to work through ways to slow down my thinking and be willing to, you know, swim upstream, as it were, to break that habit of sorts. So it's a thing I think a lot of people struggle with, obviously. Otherwise, the herd wouldn't exist in that sense. But I think it is a thing worth calling out. You know, you don't have to follow the herd into day one, Mike. It's okay.
True. Another interesting
maybe that
thing.
Was low.
Well, I feel like I was there before the herd even got there.
The herd's I've been following using you. How about that? So long.
Sure, sure. One thing that really fascinated me in this whole section of following the herd, though, is the spotlight effect, because this totally applies to me, where you believe that everyone is looking at and watching you, and in reality, people are paying less attention to you than you really think. But I have definitely struggled with this. It's also kind of interesting that we find ourselves in the situation now where I haven't really left the house in weeks. Our church does these like drive-in services on Sunday mornings where everybody goes in their cars and you tune in on the radio. But other than that, like, we just stay home. So I'm not around other people and I'm not been worried about what they think. But totally, when I'm out in public, I'm always like, are they looking at me? Do I have something in my teeth? You know?
Yes, you do. 100% every time.
That's why podcasting is so great. Nobody can see.
Oh, so that's why you don't like the whole Zoom live video thing. Got it. Got it.
Another interesting tidbit from here, by the way, that I jotted down in my mind note file was that people tend to eat more when they're in a group.
Yeah.
These numbers are crazy. They said that when you're with one other person, you tend to eat 35% more, 75% more if you're in groups of four, and 96% more than you would if you were alone if you're in a group of seven or more. I think I must be the exception to this rule, because I tend to, if I'm alone, just keep eating. But I don't know. Does this apply to you?
I feel like I'm not, because I feel like if there's a lot of people there, my tendency is to want to make sure that everybody has enough. So I don't tend to eat more. I will eat more if we're out at a restaurant. But that's because
yeah,
I feel because
they give you huge portions.
Yeah, I feel like it's rude with enough. Like, if it's just me and my wife, we have zero issues. Just give me a box, I'll take it home. But for some reason, I don't feel like I could do that with a whole group of people. Now, if it was our small group who we've been together with since, you know, how long has it been? 8 years now. I would totally do it with them. But if it was a group that I was new to, I don't know why that is. I don't feel comfortable doing that. So I'm very likely to eat more in that scenario.
Another thing that I got from this section on the following the herd is that the most powerful nudges happen with unanimous groups. And there's this concept called collective conservatism, where the tendency of the group is to stick to established patterns. I feel like, again, I recognize like times when this has been true, but also find myself maybe not fitting into the mold on this one either, because I'm the type of person where if you tell me this is the way that we do things, part of me is like, well, okay, we're going to follow the rules. But part of me is like, I'm not going to do that. Why? Because you told me to. I'm going to do it a different way. So do you think that personality plays into this following the herd mentality?
I think it depends on the scenario, because I feel like there are, like, in the case of you and I, if a whole bunch of creators were using a new app, let's take Rome Research again, a whole bunch of people are using it, we're not as inclined to just follow the herd in that case, because we've been around it, we've got a lot of experience with it, so we're not as inclined to just jump on the bandwagon. But I feel like if we were brand new to the productivity space and choosing these tools, I feel like if that were the case, we would be much more likely to just jump on. It's like, oh, everybody's talking about that. Maybe I should too. Like, I feel like that's what we would end up doing. So I think it depends.
Sure. What about priming? That was the other thing in this section. I got a lot of notes from this particular section. But
I feel like this is one that was the most interesting to me. Like, it was the most... the one that had the most potential action items, even though I have none, but...
Spoiler alert. This is the section that is most consistent with my preconceived notion of what this book would be, which is kind of like the science and how this stuff plays out, rather than a whole bunch of scenarios on where you can apply nudges to improve outcomes for people, which is kind of the other chapters or the other sections of the book. But priming is basically a subtle influence that can increase the ease with which certain information comes to mind. So an example they gave of this was asking people if they were going to vote the day before of an election increased the percentage of people who voted by 25%, which is kind of crazy. I get it, though. And again, this is something that doesn't apply to me personally recently because we just went through this in Wisconsin. They went ahead with the primary election at the beginning of April after a bunch of back and forth politically about whether they were going to push back the election or not. And I remember at the time when everybody was being told to stay home, they were canceling school. I was like, well, why don't they just announce it right now? They're going to push this back. But they didn't. And then the governor tried to delay it like a couple days before. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court jumped in and was like, no, you can't do that. So they forced everybody to go to the polls anyways. And I'm watching all this play out. Meanwhile, the minute that we heard schools were shut down, we're like, oh, the election's coming up. We better request our absentee ballots. So we didn't have to deal with any of this. Because that was the thing that they were arguing about was like, well, there's not enough time now. People won't be able to get their absentee ballots. They won't be counted. And I was just like, we took care of this already, so there's none. No, yeah. No, I can't say that that's always been the case. There have been times where it's like, oh yeah, I forgot we got to vote today, but whatever. Like this particular scenario, you know, we avoided that whole thing. So that really just fought against a little bit some of this stuff as I was reading it, because you're hearing the authors talk about how these nudges can get people to do the right things. And these are kind of necessary because look, people aren't going to go vote unless you tell them to go vote tomorrow, you know? But meanwhile, I'm getting texts all day, every day telling me who to vote for. And I'd sent in my ballot already. So I understand the nudges, but I also think the big takeaway from this is that maybe the nudges aren't so necessary if you have a little bit of self-determination and personal responsibility and you have the systems in place to think about these things before it becomes critical. Like maybe that reduces the effectiveness of the nudges a little bit. Maybe it doesn't, you know, I'm not sure. But I feel like there's some cherry-picked examples here of like, this is how people behave. And then it's just interesting to me because recently I've completely bucked those trends showing that there is at least the possibility of an alternate approach here.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I love it when I'm like, okay, this is going to be a big problem. Oh yeah, we took care of that like 3 weeks ago. Not an issue. All right. So the next part in this book is about money. And I need to get it open because I need to run through the sections. I don't have them up right in front of me. So there's four different chapters in this section. Save more tomorrow, naive investing, credit markets, privatizing Social Security, smorgasbord style. And I don't want to say that I have a ton of like financial advice type background, but I've studied a lot of like markets and investment strategies and, you know, buying or selling puts and calls on the stock market. Like I've done a lot of research on that, done a lot of it. And, you know, my wife and I do not have credit cards. Like we're kind of on the fringes with all of this. And I read all of these chapters and found myself like arguing with them a lot. And like they're not wrong with these things. Like they're talking about like setting up defaults for savings accounts, 401ks, so that whenever you join, you're set up the best for the future. I feel like that's probably the best way to do that. They tended to go just a little too far, I felt, in making recommendations on how to do that. And that's where I started to, no, you cannot do that.
Yeah.
You are not financial advisors. Please stop. Don't go there.
That could be said about every section from here on out, to be honest.
Exactly. So it was interesting to read. You're going to start to figure out my feelings on this book pretty quick now, but I don't think that this section was super helpful other than, okay, here's how some people make decisions with money. Yep, that ends up badly. Always does. And yep. Here you go. Best of luck. Don't screw it up. Like that. I wasn't sure what else to do with it.
Yeah. So this particular section is interesting because he's talking about the 401k stuff specifically. And I had an immediate action item where I logged into my 401k and upped my percentage that I was contributing.
Nice.
Because I was the person that he described where they took advantage of the company match, but then didn't even think about it after that. And did some quick math in my head. So this is what I make. This is how much less it would be. But, oh, that's not that much. And in the long run, whoa, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this. You know, we can survive without that little bit of extra money month to month. And it just does a lot in the long term to move us towards retirement goals. So that was a good nudge, just reading that section. But I agree that there's a lot of advice that they offer here, which is maybe unsolicited. But it's also, they use it as examples of how this stuff gets applied. There's a section in a chapter in the previous section, the humans and econ section, on choice architecture, which is probably worth unpacking real briefly here, because that's what's happening in this money section. Is they're taking a look at the systems that are created to guide people into making the right decisions when it comes to setting up something like a 401k. And so they map out in the money section the different approaches that you actually could take with this. So you could force people into a default being the conservative fund, or you could make the default the aggressive fund, or you could just rely on people to sign up for their 401ks and not tell them that, hey, this is available, or you could force people into the 401k, you know, all of that stuff. And then where's the balance and the right way to do this sort of thing? And it's interesting because I've been in those meetings and sitting there hearing the explanations of the plans and my eyes glazing over because I don't understand a word that they're saying at that point. Just let me out of here, sort of a thing, you know? And I do think that there are people like past me who ideally you should just tell them, like, be an adult and figure this stuff out. But not everybody's going to do that. And there are areas of my life where I still haven't done that, to be fair. So do you just let people do their thing, or do you create a system that kind of guides them into the right choices? And then along with that, obviously, is what are the right choices? What are the incentives here? And they've got four questions that they talk about in choice architecture. Who chooses, basically, who pays for it, who profits from it, you know, and those are all things that you have to answer in order to understand the choice architecture that has been employed here. Because in the back of your mind, and there's a chapter on this later, but in kind of a seed as I was going through this book was, well, this is great, assuming that noble people with pure motives are the ones manipulating this choice architecture. But what about the bad guys? What about the credit card companies who are trying to get the college students who have $100,000 in student loans to sign up for a credit card too? You know, there's people who have self-serving interests that are going to be using these nudges as well. And at this point, they're basically just not even going there. They're trying to say, well, these are some examples of both sides of, or both extremes, like ways that people have done this sort of thing. And here's what we propose is the right path forward. But again, not that simple, not cut and clear for everybody.
Yeah. My mom works for, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show or not before, but my mother works for one of the big credit card companies in the call center. And sometimes she will tell us stories of how some of her calls go. And it just amazes me. the financial misunderstanding that people have on a lot of things. The most basic being, and they have a whole, like they have a set of scripts to handle people who call in who don't understand why they have a bill to pay. Like, because credit cards are free money, right? Like that's the expectations. That's what people think. I don't know where this thought process came from, but she regularly has people who call in and they have like a $10,000 limit on a credit card, which is pretty high. And they have spent all of that. And now they're at the point where they have to pay that back, but they don't realize that it's credit. They think it was just free money.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it's fascinating to me because we don't keep a credit card balance. We hardly ever use the card and it's set to auto pay the whole balance every single month. But I know that we don't use it a whole lot. And frequently there is no balance on the card. And every once in a while, I'll get these emails like, good news, we upped your credit limit. It's now like $30,000 or whatever.
Right.
Like,
right.
I'm never going to spend that much.
Yes.
But
yes.
They're trying to entice you, obviously, to spend more with it. I can buy a car with my credit card. Why would I ever do that?
This is a great idea, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
The piece about this that I feel is at least helpful is, you know, they talk about setting up by default when you join a new employer's plan that you would just by default be saving the expected amount, whatever that is, 3%, 5%, depends on the company. You would be automatically saving a certain amount and you would be automatically enrolled in the company match program unless you decline it. Like that sort of thing I get and I tend to appreciate because otherwise, you know, the people who don't realize that credit cards need to be paid off would not have any savings at all. So I feel like that's at least helpful. But at the same time, I'm a bit conflicted because I have a tendency to put a lot of value on personal responsibility with this sort of thing. And, you know, this is where I start to get conflicting thoughts in my own head. And I don't really understand how I can hold conflicting thoughts in my head. And the dissonance sometimes causes problems for my brain. So, you know, in one sense, I like having those defaults for the people who don't understand it, but at the same time, I don't understand why the people who don't understand it don't try to understand it.
Sure.
If you followed my train of thought there, because I kind of messed with you there. But I feel like there is a bit on each individual person, and this is something I kept thinking about through this whole book, is there has to be an element that you allow a person to make decisions for themselves. You know?
Yep.
But at the same aspect, and we'll get into this on the next one with health, you have things like obesity rates that are through the roof. And not every scenario, but some of those scenarios are personal choices that lead to obesity. And why is that? Like, why do we tend to choose that? Well, I think that this is kind of getting at something. Like if we don't have things or people or systems that nudge us in the right direction, our own inclinations would be to just go down whatever feels good. And that's not always the best path in the long run. So
right.
That's where I get conflicted on this, Mike.
Well, this section in particular on credit cards, because there's a whole chapter on this, their solution to this, the possible nudges that they outline, are to highlight the fees on people's statements and don't make the minimum payments so easy. And that sounds great, but what if you rack up because you have no self-control and you've got a $10,000 limit, even though you've got $100 in the bank, you rack up a huge credit card bill. It doesn't matter if the default is to pay off the entire balance at that point. You don't have the ability to do that. And that is a separate activity from the transaction where you don't actually give the retailer any money when you buy something. There's a disconnect there where a simple nudge when it comes to thinking about the numbers, I don't think it fixes it. And so that's kind of prevalent, I think, in a lot of these examples going forward. in is that the solution is really not as simple as they make it out to be. I feel like there's a lot more complexity to these things, and a big piece of it, you're right, has to do with your ability to delay the gratification and say no to some things, because you just don't have the ability to do that when it comes to credit cards in particular.
So let's take a look at health here. So this is the third part of this whole piece, and they cover three individual areas: prescription drugs, organ donations, and environmental, saving the planet, as they call it. And
I don't get that under health, but okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, I might be able to get that one. And that it's only because with my health conditions that I've been fighting, I have a tendency to see how the environment around me impacts my health significantly. So maybe I could see how they get there. I feel like they wanted to talk about it, and they don't, like, if you look at the parts and the section headings, there's not really a good place for them to put it.
Yeah, every chapter, every section needs to have three chapters.
Exactly. From so this point they so. Kind of had to stick it somewhere, I feel. I can't say that I follow a lot of these particular pieces. Maybe you had a better grasp of what they were getting at with some of this, Mike, but like they're talking about prescription drugs and what the best practices are for, you know, the plans by which you would get them. Obviously, in the US of A, we have kind of a runaway train when it comes to healthcare prices and such. So this is obviously a big problem that is yet to be solved. I don't think anybody would argue with that. Both sides of the aisle tend to agree that it is an issue. So, you know, there's that piece. I can't really say that I like a lot of what they talked about, but I also don't know what the answers are. Organ donations, they tended to say that there should be like a default answer of yes, you will by default donate all of your organs once you're passed, with the thought process that you no longer have any, you know, will to live at that point. Obviously, you are dead. So you should obviously donate for anyone who could use your organs. Just making that default, that way you could save more people. And then they get into a lot of the environmental side of things and talking about the EPA and such. It's like, okay, I have a lot of strong opinions on about this, but I don't know that I'm going to talk about them because, you know, life. So anyway, thoughts on this, Mike?
I think the how to increase organ donations chapter 11 is the easiest one to get on board with, because they make the point that many people who are willing to be donors aren't donors simply because of the required explicit consent that we have in the US. But there are other options available for how that works, where instead of checking the box to explicitly be an organ donor, you can also make it check the box to not be an organ donor, so you're kind of presuming consent, or you can force people to pick one, but provide nudges along the way as to what you want them to do, which is to be an organ donor. And I thought it was interesting that most states in the US have explicit consent. That's the way it is here in Wisconsin. What's it like in Minnesota? Do you have to check the box?
You do. Yeah, it's explicit consent.
Okay. But in Europe, they have presumed consent. And I get the complications with that, although I don't think I personally would have any issues with that, where after I'm dead, my family members are like, no, don't cut him open and take his heart. I don't really care. I'm an organ donor, for full disclosure. I checked the box.
Right. I did too, which is why I'm like, maybe that's a good thing. Like, they're going to cremate me anyway. So what's the big deal? So that's my stance.
Yeah. And I thought this section was interesting just in the fact that you could communicate how many lives could be saved if you do check the box. And then forcing people to make a choice that way is probably enough to get people to pick the right thing for them. And if they really have an objection to it, they have a easy out right there. But otherwise, you don't have to use a default as like an excuse for, well, I wish we had an organ, but we don't because they didn't check the box, or just default to it, you know, and then you've got a stockpile of organs, but you've got upset family members. The other ones, I think, are more complicated. The prescription drugs thing, this they talked a lot about the Part D, the Medicare Part D thing that they passed in like 2000 or something like that. And the big thing with this being that it was too complicated for people to choose. The tool that was designed to help them, the website, was pretty much impossible to use. They had people on their staff who tried to pick the best option for them given certain criteria, and three different people got three different answers. I mean, that obviously shows that the website was poorly designed, and you could argue that there were too many choices for elderly people to try and figure this out on their own. But I also kind of think that maybe the emphasis here being on like the website being too hard to use. This is a circa 2000 website, and I'm not sure that just because it's a newer website, it would be easier. But also, maybe we've learned something in our web design mistakes since then. So how does this play out, you know, if we were to do it now? And I don't know what the answer is there. Reading through that description they had of the Medicare Part D, it's easy to see the problems with it because they had like 47 different choices. But that's kind of retroactively saying, well, obviously this is what was wrong here. And I think it's easy to do that with something that happened in the past. I think it's harder to say, well, this is the right way to approach it going forward. So I don't really want to touch that one. And then the saving the planet thing, this one kind of irked me because their solution, again, is go ahead and pollute if you want to, just pay the tax. And I don't know. It's oversimplistic, I feel like. I did like the nudge examples from this section where they had like the redone fuel emissions stickers and the Energy Star savings. I think, you know, those are examples that most people are familiar with, so you can see how that stuff would pan out. But I bristle a little bit at the idea of just because I bought a cheap water heater because it's the only one I could afford at the time for my house, that I'm going to get taxed because it's using a lot of energy.
Yeah, I like the, you know, the nudges within the Saving the Planet section around how to encourage people to use less energy or buy a vehicle that's more fuel efficient. I understand those, and I think it's helpful. I will be completely honest and upfront that I have kind of a gearhead background and have a thing for cars. So whenever I see these fuel economy estimates and these stickers on the cars, I have a tendency to want vehicles that specifically have a lower number on the fuel economy scale, just because that tells me that it can do things I like doing.
Sure.
I'll stop there. So I tend to take advantage of that in the opposite direction. And I know I have a handful of friends that would do the exact same. At the same time, I've also got a large group of friends that have talked about how that's helpful and have chosen vehicles that are more fuel efficient as a result of those. So this, I feel like this does work in a good way overall, but I feel that people in the car community who like performance vehicles will have a tendency to take advantage of this in a negative way. Okay. I'll stop on that. Yeah, I don't think I have anything else to say about this particular section. I feel that the next one on freedom is a little more of interest. And there are, again, three chapters here. And those are improving school choices. Should patients be forced to buy lottery tickets? And privatizing marriage. I can kind of get on board with the school choices thing where you're helping students make better choices for the long run, because I feel like kids don't always have the best decisions for themselves. I know that we have a tendency to want kids to be able to make decisions for themselves, but, you know, I think, Mike, you would agree with me that that's fine along with strong prodding in the correct direction. So, yes.
Yeah. This one, though, really isn't about the kids. It's about the parents. So
yeah, that's fair.
again, like, this is difficult. I did think the examples that they shared where they had one school district in particular, and I'm blanking on the name, where all of the schools pretty much in that area were below average. And so they basically went in there as like, this is the place where people should want to change. And they talked about how complicated and convoluted the process was, and all the way along, like, the parents had to schedule a meeting with the principal. Then they had another meeting where they were at the school's information center, and every single step of the way, the officials are stressing that transfers aren't always possible and transportation's not guaranteed. And I totally get where all of that stuff happens before the paperwork even gets filled out. You're probably not going to fill out the paperwork. Nah, this is good enough. We'll just make it work. So yeah, many parents didn't do it, but should they do it? I don't know. I think that depends on a lot of different factors. If the officials who are saying that transportation isn't guaranteed to your new school are correct, then maybe from an educational standpoint, yeah, Johnny should be going to the other school across town where he'll get a better education. But if mom and dad both work and they can't get him there, that doesn't matter. So in that case, the nudge is appropriate. But if they're just trying to keep people in their school district so they can check all the boxes, you know, and keep enrollment up and all that, then that's not an appropriate nudge. There's so much nuance to this type of stuff. The one thing here that I really wanted to chat with you about was the whole nudging towards college. They mentioned in San Marcos, they required an application to the local community college for high school graduation. And I get it on the surface, you know, if you get accepted, you don't have to go there. It's free to fill it out, yada, yada, yada. At least you have the option. But this is, again, presuming that college is the right answer. And I'm not so positive it is. We probably don't have time to get into a whole bunch of debate here, but
sure.
I went to a private liberal arts college that put my wife and I about $100,000 in debt. It took us a really long time to pay that off, and I use approximately zero of what I learned there. Now, I still learned a lot during the process. Was it worth the cost? I don't know. I'm not presuming, though, that telling my kids that when they graduate from high school, that yeah, the right thing is that you go sign up for more student debt and learn some skills that are antiquated in today's economy. I mean, that's kind of the whole idea behind Omar Zenholm. If you know his story, he was a business professor at a big university and was trying to impose some new curriculum, and it had to go through the committee, and he realized that it's going to be 3 years before this even gets approved. And I'm sick of teaching people to manage factories when they're going to be working online. So I'm just going to go create a website, the $100 MBA, call it a day. You know, I think there's some truth to that. We read the personal MBA, and I feel like those types of programs, it's not a one-to-one with an MBA program. You have to realize that. But the information that is really going to help you, the relevant stuff, maybe isn't taught in a classroom after it's been reviewed by a university. And I don't know. I think things change really fast. So just the whole idea of college is the automatic right next step for people. For a lot of people, yeah, but not for everybody. And I think there's a lot more to consider there before you make that choice.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about the requirement to fill out an application to graduate high school. I haven't quite figured out my thoughts on that particular piece, though I have thought about it quite a bit. And that's primarily because I don't know, I don't know the area, and I don't know the type of student that they're dealing with very well. And I feel like there's potentially a lot of benefit to that. Maybe it's a great thing. Obviously, I feel that it would increase the number of students going to college. But to your point, I don't know how much of college I would say is required. I will say that, like, as far as our kids go, we tend to just talk with them with the assumption that they will go to college. Like, we have a tendency to say, well, yeah, after high school when you get to college, like, this is what life could look like. We'll have those conversations as they come up, but that's just the way that we tend to reference that. It's not a thing that, like, we expect you to go to college. That's not it at all. We just talk as if the assumption is there. Though, if any of my girls mention that they don't feel that that's the right move, you better believe I'm going to be right behind them trying to figure out how I can help them best to set themselves up for a successful future. But I'm not sold on college either. I think there's, you know, the master's degree has become the new BA. So I feel like that's kind of where we've landed. It frustrates me when pretty much everybody can get a BA when they go to college. I feel like it's an option. Like, you have to work to get that, not just pay for it. So rant's over. I don't know how I feel about this particular scenario with the application piece, but I know that in our specific case, I find encouraging that to be, at least for now, the right direction that we're going to head towards.
Yeah, you should consider it as an option, but you should not, I don't think, nudge people in that direction, which kind of gets at the bigger underlying issue with everything in this book, is who gets to decide what the right thing to do is. It's not the people who wrote this book, I think. And if I'm in that situation, by the way, I'm not necessarily against the filling out of the application. I would probably advise my kids, yeah, go just fill out the application. It takes half an hour, and then you've at least got the ability to fall back on that if you want. It's more the psychological emphasis on, like, this is what you should be doing. And maybe that's just the rebel in me bristling at people saying, hey, you should be doing this. But I don't know. It's not as simple as they make it out to be in the 15 pages that they devote to the topic. Same thing with the next chapter on should patients be forced to buy lottery tickets. I mean, there's a nudge right in the title of basically healthcare is the lottery. Insurance is a lottery. And you can kind of guess where they land on that side of the argument of whether or not you should have insurance, whether or not, what, you know, medical insurance is kind of their emphasis in this particular chapter, but you can apply that to other things. Should you be required to have car insurance when you're driving on the road? Should you be required to have homeowners insurance? Should you be required to have life insurance? I mean, there's so much more to unpack here. Let's just take the home insurance thing as an example. You could make the argument that I have the right to not buy home insurance. And I understand the risk that if my house goes up in flames, that my stuff is gone and I'm okay with that. But what about then the people who respond to the 911 call? Do they ask you when you call, do you have homeowners insurance? Oh, sorry. Well, we only have so many firefighters, so we're going to do it. We're going to try to save the people who have the insurance first because they're paying for it. You know, this, and that's a ridiculous example, but I don't think it's too far-fetched because of where we find ourselves with the whole coronavirus thing either, because the whole argument that people were making at the beginning of this is you got to flatten the curve because otherwise we're going to have more cases of this than we have healthcare capacity. And at that point, you've got to decide who you're going to take care of. You're triaging your patients, just like the Napoleonic War. Who are the ones who are probably going to survive? We'll leave them alone. Who are the ones that are probably going to die? We'll leave them alone. And who are the ones where we can really make a difference? Those are the ones who are going to be allowed in the hospitals. No one likes that scenario. And I think being asked to make those types of decisions, rightfully so, feels wrong to a lot of people. But the minute that you frame insurance as a lottery ticket, that's kind of what you're encouraging.
Right. I'm, of course, extremely biased with the healthcare system. I have lots and lots of opinions. My wife and I are technically uninsured in the world of health insurance, which always freaks people out when I say that. But we're a part of a healthcare sharing ministry, so we do have that. I find that it's actually way cheaper and has better coverage. Just going to say that. I have lots of opinions on that, of course. I also have lots of opinions about the privatizing marriage piece that are more religious than they are anything. So I feel it's probably better for me to just skip that part here. If either of those two is of any strong interest to you, reach out to me somewhere online, email me, etc. We can have discourse about it as long as it's cordial.
Well, let me just say one thing about that chapter. Sure. I don't have many notes, but I already shared their solution when I used this chapter as an example early on. But they define this very loosely, the goal of marriage being to protect people's commitments to each other. And I feel that explanation right there kind of invalidates a lot of what they're going to propose after that. Because that's how you're going to define it. That's fine. But you can't just say this is the blanket definition for everyone. And you could make that argument about any of the things that they discuss in parts two, three, or four in this book. So I agree with you. Like, my solution isn't their solution, but recognize where they're coming from and the formula that they're following for this book. So my real issue is not that they think they have a solution for privatizing marriage, because they also have one for privatizing Social Security and lots of other stuff. But they boil it down into something that is, they try to make something really, really complex and complicated very, very simple. And I don't think they do it justice.
All right, last part here. Extensions and objections. And there is, again, three chapters here. A dozen nudges, objections, the real third way. And the piece of this, you can cover the other two if you want to, Mike, but the piece of this that I wanted to just mention briefly is a dozen nudges. And it's because these are kind of like mini, smaller nudges as compared to what they've been talking about throughout the rest of this book. And I can't say that any of them in particular jumped out at me, other than the fact that this concept is what I kind of expected from the entire book, not just the end. Like, I kind of thought whenever I picked this up that it was going to be like how to help yourself and others make better choices through some minor pieces like this, not these massive infrastructure pieces that they're talking about. So that's really the only piece that I wanted to call out here. I just thought it was an interesting way to do it, and it was a the way that I expected the entire book to go.
I agree. The objections section is interesting to me because they talk about the objections that people are going to have to their libertarian paternalism being a slippery slope, and they have three questions. Do the arguments have merit? Actually, the next ones aren't questions, but they're arguments. They argue that with their models, freedom of choice is optimized, and it's naive to think that government won't nudge people anyways. And then they address the evil nudgers, that bad people will manipulate the nudge, and they ask, should we worry more about public choice architects than private choice architects? I feel like that's very fair to ask that. But on page 245, you get the summary of their arguments here. And I think this is interesting given the current situation we find ourselves in as we record this. So they say, we think a good society makes trade-offs between protecting the unfortunate and encouraging initiative and self-help. So when I read this, I immediately thought of all of the arguments on both sides that are happening right now with the state stay-at-home orders. Because on the one hand, you've got the people saying, well, if you go outside and you have coronavirus and you're asymptomatic and you don't even know that you have it, older people are susceptible. They're going to catch it. They're going to die. So it's not right for you to leave your house. I get that argument. There are also people saying, well, we can't just stay locked up forever. We're already in the middle of a recession, which is kind of like the biggest one since the Great Depression. So many millions of people are filing for unemployment. The economy is not going to bounce back till the middle of the next decade, yada, yada, yada. I understand that argument. You see the dilemma here. How do you get people back to work in a safe way? And I think this argument could be made for either either camp maybe that you would might find yourself in. As we see this play out in real time, by the way, it tends to be very politicized. So the Democrats tend to be the ones, just stay home. The Republicans are the ones saying the economy is going to tank. We're never going to recover from this. I think that it's, again, more complicated than either one of those simple definitions of this. So I'm not proposing a right way to handle this. I'm glad I'm not the one having to make the decisions here, because this is potentially a lot of people's blood on your hands. But also, this book was written in 2007, I think. And so when they said this, it probably sounded really, really good. And when I read this now, I'm like, this is really, really ridiculous. Because how do you define that? How do you define where to make the trade-offs between protecting the unfortunate, encouraging initiative and self-help? How do you make the distinction between the trade-off of protecting people by telling them to stay home and encouraging their initiative and self-help to provide for themselves and their families? It's not simple. And so this statement jumped out to me because this is in the second to last section of the book, the last chapter here. This is kind of like the bow on all of their arguments. Like, aha, here we go. This is the solution, people. Let's just be rational. And we're literally, as I read this, in the middle of a situation, we're like, what does this even mean?
Good job, Mike. I think I have reached the end of my thoughts on this book as far as the content goes. Do you have anything else you want to say about it?
No, other than so many questions.
Yes.
That I'm going to have to wrestle with. Again, that's not a bad thing. That's not a judgment on the book itself. Maybe that's the design of the book itself.
Sure.
But it's not going to give you a simple five-step formula for saving an hour a day.
Sure. Any action items out of this one? I have none.
Well, I started to write down the action item to adjust my 401k, then I just went and did it.
So I guess you could say check it off.
I started to write it down. You know what? This is stupid. I can do this online. Let's just go do it.
Sure. Makes sense.
So that technically was an action item at one point, but not anymore. It's already done.
All right. So I have none for action items, which brings us to style and rating. I suppose I get to go first on this one. I can honestly say I did not expect to be reading a political book. I did not know that's what we were picking up. I feel a little bit cheated on that because based on descriptions and things that I was reading, I was expecting something that would, I guess, help guide some personal decision making, not here's the way we should set up Social Security. Like, that is not what I was expecting at all. So I'm a bit frustrated by that. I won't argue that, you know, their writing style is one that is set up pretty well, I feel. They would share a lot of issues and struggles and why things don't work in the current scenario, and then they would make recommendations after they've discussed all those about what nudges they would recommend in order to prevent that from being a long-term or a bigger problem and helping solve it. So kudos to them on setting it up that way. I feel like that was done pretty well. I simply disagree with them on so many things that it was difficult for me to be, I guess, objective in going through the book because I had so many things that I was arguing with them on. This was a case where I was more frustrated after reading this than I felt I got value from it. So that made it a challenge. I can't say I'm going to recommend this one. Like, if you have it and you really want to read it and you want to see what I'm talking about, sure, go for it. But probably not going to mention this one to very many, if anybody. So this is something that I would just say, just skip it, is my opinion. As far as how to rate it, you know, it's a challenge because I feel like it was well written. I just didn't care for the content of it overall. Like, obviously, there's some points in here that I thought were interesting. The very beginning I felt was helpful, but the back four parts I struggled with some exceptions here and there. So how do you rate that when you just flat disagree with the content? So I think I'm going to put it at a 3 because I'm struggling where else to put it, because I don't feel like it is worth, in my opinion, higher than that, but I don't feel like I can go below that, so I'm going to stick it in the middle at 3, somewhere in there. I suppose middle would be, what, 2.5?
Yeah. But
I'll stick it at 3. Yeah, I'm done talking about it. 3.0, there you go.
I wish I had that graph. I'm curious how many books you have ever rated below 3. Let me see if I can find
this. Oh, that's right.
Quick.
We just, somebody charts this. I need to pull that up. Here we go. I have below 3. I've rated, what am I? I'm red on this chart. I yep. have rated 4 books below 3.
All right. Out of 90 something.
You've done 2.
That's true. Mine go lower though.
That's true. True that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get down to the 1.5. What was the 1.5?
That might have been Zen.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So this book is, I don't know how to describe it. On one hand, it is fascinating to me because, like you, I disagree with a lot of stuff that's in here. But also, I think that it was ambitious to take the approach that they did. I agree with you. It's not what I expected. And if I were to recommend something to somebody along this topic, it would be Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. In fact, the first section of the book, The Humans and Econs, it felt a lot like that book. There were a lot of the same stories, a lot of the same principles that were discussed as Thinking Fast and Slow. So if that's what you're interested in, that book gets into the mechanics of how these things are done. And I think it was not a terrible idea to address some of these taboo topics that nobody wants to talk about. It does make you uncomfortable when you read them because you don't have these discussions about whether you should be advertising credit cards or how to encourage people to be responsible with saving the planet. And this is not something that people like to talk about. And I actually enjoyed reading through these because I liked the arguments that they made, even though I, again, like you, I disagree with some of their outcomes and I feel like they oversimplified stuff. It was kind of refreshing to have a book that was willing to tackle that stuff as opposed to just talking about the mechanics and like, well, this is playing out in real time in front of us right now in this scenario, but we're not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. Like that's typically what people would do with a lot of this stuff. And they're like, no, we're going to try and explain this the best that we can. Here's the arguments to our understanding. And here's kind of the middle ground that we think people should do. And again, I don't agree with a lot of their solutions, but that's because of my biases. I get that. And everybody's going to have their biases. So I don't think the approach is necessarily a bad thing, but definitely not what we expected. And not something that I think really impacts me, at least in my day-to-day, as I'm finished reading Nudge, and I think about, okay, what did this book do to me? I don't know. I feel kind of numb. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of impact for me here, which is different than a lot of the other books that we read. Like, I remember Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. That was... There's no specific action items from that in terms of like, this is what I'm going to do in my day-to-day productivity workflow, you know, but that totally changed my perspective on things. This book didn't totally change my perspective on things. It also didn't give me the little adjustments, which is really what we look for in terms of action items. It was simply an entertaining read, in my opinion, by a couple of really smart professors who at times can sound a little bit the language that they use and the way that they describe things, you know, it can be a little bit, I don't know, it's not difficult to read, but it's dry, I guess. I mean, this is an economic book, kind of. Like you mentioned political book. I think while the libertarian paternalism that they talk about could be classified as like a political system and the third way, whatever. I really do think that at the heart of the arguments that they're making, they're trying to just propose a better way to maximize the economic value for all the people that are involved in the system. So if economics is your thing, then maybe this is worth a read. But otherwise, I think I would probably stay away from it. I'm going to rate it at a 3.5, I think, just because I respect the fact that they tried to tackle a bunch of taboo topics. I think they did a pretty good job of explaining the things. You know, if I were to write this, people would disagree with my conclusions too. I understand that you're not going to please everybody, but kudos for trying. It's a decent book. Definitely not what we expected when we went into this. Probably not the type of thing that we would, had we known exactly what this was, you know, the typical type of book for Bookworm, but that's okay. I'm glad that I read it. Probably never going to read it again.
Yeah, I'd join you on that one. All right. I'm happy to put this one on the shelf. What's our next pick, Mike?
The next book is my Gap book from yesteryear, Tiny Habits by BJ Fogg. This one I bought, I think, after I visited you. I saw it in the airport, but I didn't buy it in the airport because books are expensive in the airport.
Nice. Yeah, and after Tiny Habits, we're going to do Stillness is the Key by Ryan Holiday. Ryan Holiday, we did one of his books way back towards the beginning of Bookworm, but this is one that came out just this past year. I've been seeing it make the rounds. People have been talking about it. It's a New York Times bestseller, that sort of thing. So I'm excited to go through this one. I feel like this one's going to hit me at the right season in life. So yeah, Stillness is the Key, Ryan Holiday. I think we've talked about this already, but Gap book, Mike?
Yep.
I know I do not.
Oh, no, I do not have any Gap books. Stillness is the Key actually was a Gap book for me, though, so I have read this one previously. I'm excited to go through it again, though. I really enjoyed it the first time. Spoiler alert.
Nice. Well, big kudos to all of you members who are listening in live. We really appreciate you joining us as we do this a week prior to the release. So thanks for joining us on that. If you're interested in becoming a member, want to listen to these live, chat with us as we record these episodes, you can do that at bookworm.fm/membership. And it just helps us keep the show running. And you get access to a few special things. We've talked about this numerous times, but the fun one lately has been the live recordings and just joining us for those. So yeah, if you're interested in supporting the show, bookworm.fm/membership.
All right. So if you are reading along with us, pick up Tiny Habits by BJ Fogg, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.